Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Living in the Light. Let's start with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master, Paramhansa Yogananda, dearest Swamiji, help us to feel your presence. Keep us company, heart, mind, and spirit, that as we move through this world, we know that we are never alone. Like a mother bird guarding her chicks, your eyes and your heart and your mind is always with us. Inspire us that our eyes and our hearts and our minds be always with you. Om. Peace. Amen. I'm going to do a little bit of, I won't call it self-promotion, I will just call it information. Many of you, well, no, not many of you, but for the last 4 or 5 months, I've been recording a podcast which is based on Swami's book. Could you hand me the book so I could just hold it up because I moved my coffee? Thank you. Based on Swami's book, Living Wisely, Living Well, which is daily aphorisms for timeless wisdom to enrich every day. And it's an absolutely incredibly good book. I don't like to just use superlatives. I like to tell you why. It covers an extraordinarily vast number of subjects, and in a matter of just a few words, gives us extremely helpful and accurate things that we can do to transform our lives day by day. I took it on because I had spare time here in this seclusion, and I was energy was too agitated for me to think about writing, and I just didn't feel any inspiration, so talking is easier. So a few months ago, I just stepped into it with the thought that we could do all the whole year, and then people could subscribe, and then every day they would get Living Wisely, Living Well, 15 minutes. I read it, I comment on it, then I read it again. I knew it would be good, but I was amazed, have been amazed, just how much wisdom Swami can just pack into a few words and sort of what a window it is. I mean, on how to communicate fashion, color, criticism, self-blame, self-acceptance, money. I mean, just everything. It's all there. 366 of them. After I was about 60 into it, I realized 366. Oh my gosh, it was just overwhelming. But patient application of willpower. And yesterday I finished recording. And Vivani, who helps me with the technical side of things, brought me a beautiful bouquet of flowers that looks just like this. A little bit of chocolate and a little bit of fruit. We had a small celebration. But it's already been launched. And we haven't really gotten our communication system in order to really let people know what's happening. But I really know very little about podcasts. I mean, how the whole delivery system works. But I know if you go to Apple Podcasts, I believe there's a page that's related to me. And I believe it's available, as they say, where podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts. Living Wisely, Living Well with Asha Nayaswamy. I think you'll like it. If my experience recording it is any judge, I think that Swamiji had a lot to say. And I think you'll have lots of fun with it. So I just wanted to let you know, and actually while I'm chatting, I'm about to start, as soon as I take a couple of days to breathe, I'm about to start this book, which is one of a little known jewel. It's called Images of Wisdom. And this is a collection of similes and metaphors that Jayadev in Italy collected out of Swami's written words. It used to be called like a ray of light, and I think I may yet give it another name. But this book is almost unknown, and this has 265, I think, aphorisms of a very, very different type. So I'm going to also start working on this, but this can be months before it's done. Okay, having said all that, let's go back to a new dispensation. So what Swami did yesterday, and I believe I actually may have duplicated, when I was speaking yesterday, I may have duplicated something I'd said about 3 or 4 days ago. I have to confess, I am doing a lot of talking in a lot of different venues, and sometimes my wires cross. But I don't think I duplicated. I think I may have just read some of the same sentences and then said something new about them. And if so, I think you can endure a few minutes of hearing the same stories, which many of you have been hearing for years anyway. So, going right along, last time, yesterday, Swami was talking about inviting people to make an affiliation. And he's talking about, he references, without offering any grim details, that there are fundamentally two of the best known organizations representing Master Spiritual Family. And they don't always agree with each other. Especially they don't always agree with Swami, having been expelled from there. And when people are expelled, they generally are not, they're expelled because they're not liked. It's very interesting that in the history of churches in America, and America is really, except for the Protestant Reformation of the whole Christian world, America is a place where churches are started. And I remember when our friends from Italy were visiting, and this was back many years ago. I mean, not that they visited since, but when they were visiting once many years ago, we were talking about church. At that point, they were visiting here in Ananda, Palo Alto, so it would have been 1994, because we were about to purchase the building that is now our self-realization temple. And it was constructed as a Catholic church, and it served as a Catholic church for about 40 years, St. Aloysius. And then now it's the Self-Realization Church of Ananda. And we were having just this conversation, and then suddenly they were talking in Italian to each other. And a spokesperson said, they just find this incomprehensible that the Catholic Church could sell their church to someone. Because in their mind, first of all, church means Catholic Church, period. There's no like churches, there's just the church. So even that concept was weird. And that a building could actually, that they would just close it and make it into another. And I was laughing because I said, in America, we start churches. I mean, I'm saying this because it's important. Like, America has a wholly different attitude towards spirituality than many of the European countries or the Asian countries. It's because we were a blank slate. And in other contexts, in these morning satsangs, I've talked a great deal about why Master came to America. I mean, Master incarnated in India, but his work and his mission was in the USA. And that wasn't random. And the mere fact of the way America was founded itself, I've expanded on these in other places, but all of this was part of this cosmic wave of Dwapara coming in, where you could go into a place that was spiritually more or less a blank slate. I mean, not that we didn't have churches, not that there wasn't an established sort of religious culture here, but the very nature of the country was intended. It was founded for religious freedom. The pilgrims fled religious persecution. And they came to America, and in their different colonies, they set up their own idea of what spirituality should look like. And then they fought each other about it. But anyway, that's just the way it was. But the country was established specifically to allow people to do that. If you're American, if you're born and raised in America, as I have been, you know, you take this in with your mother's milk, so to speak, even though I was Jewish in this country. You take this in, and this is just the way it is. It seems natural to you that people can be inspired. And when they're inspired in a spiritual way, they can be pioneers. America is a pioneering country. So you pioneer an entire religious expression, you know, whether it's Christian Science or Mormonism or some evangelical branch of Christianity. I mean, they're all over the place. I only know bits and pieces of them. But if you feel that inspiration, and the governmental structure actually even supports you, it's relatively easy. You can incorporate. as a nonprofit religious corporation, and you become a recognized legal entity based on your spiritual point of view. I mean, as the years have passed, this has all become, very systematized. And what that means is inspiration just can come anywhere. And yes, the Western side tends to institutionalize it, but the USA is extraordinarily free in what it will allow people to do and then recognize them for doing it. So, and the history of religious movements in the USA where they exist is, it goes like this. There's there's a founding energy, and only rarely is that founder an avatar, but you have a saintly, inspired person, generally speaking, who are drawing from some, from the revelation of an avatar, you know, some form of Christianity or some form of Judaism or something, where they're going from an established tenet and then they're moving from that. Nowadays, people take it much more broadly than that. But you have the founder, you have an organization start for a period of time because it's a singleton. I have to sneeze. Forgive me. Because it's a singleton, and because it's been invented, it's been received, inspired by the individuals who are right there living it. There's one entity, and they have a monopoly on it, and they've defined it. And so what happens then is that single entity becomes the definition of the orthodoxy of whatever that is. And almost always, if you study, you know, the history of religious movements in the USA, at some point there's a split within that first entity. It can happen after the founder passes and those who are left in charge disagree about the founder's intention. Sometimes it happens between the founder and a co-founder, or the founder and one of his followers. And either the individual declares his independence or her independence and goes off and makes her version of it, or the founding entity expels the one who's marching to a different drum. And then you have the first church of whatever it is of, and then suddenly you have the second church of. Because usually when that first split happens, usually the renegade, either by choice or by expulsion, the renegade still considers himself or herself to be an expression of the founding principles. He's not starting his own entity different from, he's starting his own entity loyal to, but different from. And that's how it happens. That's why you have the First Church of Christ Science, the Second Church of Christ Science, or you have slight variation. I can't remember the details, but it's like, you know, the United Methodists, the Methodists of America, the Presbyterian Conflagration, not Conflagration, but Convocation. And then you have the Presbyterian Association. You know, similar names, but slightly different. And everybody who knows the esoterica for a generation or two has to decide among all of those. So Master's work has not been different. There's the first church of and the second church of, and that's basically SRF and Ananda. And over time, it will sort itself out. But especially in 1983, it was still a little alive and well. Alive and unwell might be the way to say it. So, Swami has given, yesterday I read, he gave us two paragraphs. Go where you find inspiration. Continue to follow it. If whenever the directions change, ignore any negative reasons why you should not affiliate with others if you feel inspiration. So, Swami says, Self-Realization Fellowship and Ananda are the two best-known representatives of this family of self-realization. SRF was founded by Yogananda himself. Ananda was founded by a direct disciple, myself. Sincerely, I always appreciate that Swami just says that. Swami always, whenever he talks about SRF, he never underplays their importance, their precedence in time, And the fact that Master himself founded it, he never tries to give himself credibility by diminishing the credibility of SRF. And that is just his absolute fairness in conversation, in a discussion. He never wants to take an unfair advantage. He wants everything to be exactly as it is, and then we make a choice from that. He doesn't color it in any way at all. And that's extremely impressive. When we were dealing with the president of SRF after Master, and her behavior was less than laudable in the circumstances that we had to meet her. Unfortunately, we saw her in the least favorable circumstances that were possible in the conflict with Ananda. Yet in The Path, Swami's book, he writes about her with great devotion and great love and affection and respect. And many people at Ananda's entire picture of her was formed by Swami's adulation and praise, because we didn't know her ourselves, and he did. He spoke so highly of her. And then later she became quite a formidable adversary in our efforts to serve Master. Self-declared adversary. Swami was always quick to say, he never called anyone an adversary or an enemy or a detractor. He would always say self-declared. He would never accept the definition they chose for themselves. He never saw them in that way. But he would say self-declared adversary. So I said, sir, when you wrote The Path, you knew that this was also a potential. He said, yes, I did. I said, and you knew that by writing in the way that you did, you were actually setting yourself up to be misunderstood by your own people. He said, yes. And then he just said so simply, but every praiseworthy thing I said about her is also true. And I thought to myself, I put this story in Swami Kriyananda as we've known him. I thought to myself, it's just so honest. You know, he wants, and he trained us to want the truth. That's all. Not any particular point of view, but simply what's right. And if in order to get to what's right, we have to blind ourselves to facts or rewrite history to make it match our predisposition. In other words, if our feelings are so committed that we have to twist reason to match our feelings, then there's something very, very, very wrong. In the end, actually, in various ways, a posthumous message from one of his chief self-declared detractors, after she passed, she actually sent a message to Swamiji through someone else that had come to that man in vision, basically saying, I was acting from a previous incarnation, and I failed to understand that the events of the past were not the events of the present. And Swamiji said quite simply, he said he always felt as if their position, their perception of him was predetermined, and whatever happened in the present, they would just twist it to fit their predetermined position. You see, that's the great power of Maya, is it just confuses us. And Swami was steadfast in his determination not to allow Maya to confuse him. So he says, Self-Realization Fellowship was founded by Yogananda himself. Ananda was founded by a disciple. As soon as you say that, Ananda becomes the inferior child. And it's true in that sense. In that sense that the Master himself founded it, and he didn't found Ananda, Swami did. So he just says it without comment. Sincerely, I see no conflict between those two organizations. That the ray of divine power flows strongly through both of them is by now, after all these years, self-evident. Ananda supports Self-Realization Fellowship in every way, and urges its own members to join SRF as well. It was, for many years, it was a requirement of residency at Ananda that you also be an SRF member and take the SRF lessons. And people used to go to the SRF convocations. At a certain point, Swamiji began to be, he never told people not to associate with SRF, but he stopped insisting that we would, because too often when Ananda people went to SRF, SRF spoke strongly against him and against Ananda. And he saw that it hurt people's faith, that what happened more than Ananda, I mean, people would leave Ananda to go to SRF, but more often people would leave Master altogether, figuring if the disciples are fighting, this can't be a very good path. So he just saw that it was detrimental. So he went silent on the point. He didn't feel it was appropriate for him to forbid people to expose themselves or to be involved with SRF, but he no longer insisted on it the same way. That was a hard decision for him, I might add. I talk about that in Light Bearer. Ananda supports Self-Realization Fellowship in every way and urges its own members to join SRF as well. If there is a difference between the two works, it is only that Ananda offers greater scope for individual service to the divine ray that our line of gurus represented. Once again, isn't that just such a beautiful and generous way to put it? And the difference is community, especially at this point. Ananda was, we were just branching out into having urban centers and what would amount to churches. But we were primarily Ananda village as more than anything else. Everything else was just beginning to grow. And what that meant was you didn't have to be a monastic to be fully involved. And so the leadership and responsibility and opportunity was dispersed over many different people. In SRF, even to this day, the core of the seva, of the service of Master, is done by the monastic order. And so if you're not drawn to that lifestyle, it's hard for you to become 100%. But if you're a part of Ananda, if you're single, if you're married, if you have children, you can still be 100%. So the opportunities for service are greater, which when everything else, you know, all the other everythingnesses that you want to talk about, that's really the key. Because the opportunity to serve, the opportunity to live in spiritual community, the opportunity for ongoing dynamic satsang is a very important part of the spiritual path, which, as you recall, is what the whole point of this whole brochure has been. So then Swami says, which line then should you personally follow? I would say again, go where you feel inspired. In other words, the essence of the spiritual path is your own intuition and your own direct experience of God. Swami makes no case for his own discipleship, for what Master told him, for the commission that he was supposed to carry out, what Master may have said about SRF. He says none of that. Go where you feel inspired. In other words, the only place that God can be experienced is in your own nervous system. Pay attention to your own experience. That's what Dwapara Yuga is about. It's about the individual. It's about us learning intuitive faith in our own experience. I always, whenever I hear this, I always think of the experience of Peter, St. Peter with Jesus at the end of Jesus' life when he was cleaning house, as a master may do. He knew that the crucifixion was coming, that it was going to get very difficult to be a Christian. And there weren't even such a thing as Christians, but it was going to be very difficult to be identified as his follower. And he knew that there needed to be a very powerful core. And those who had gained something but didn't have the karma to be able to stand against the storm that was coming, he was making it possible for them to exit. So that was when he began to say, eat my body and drink my blood. And now the church has a symbolic explanation of it, but there was no symbolic explanation. And when you read in the Bible, I love this part. Jesus says, eat my body and drink my blood. And the disciples said one to another, this is from the Bible, this is a hard teaching. And it says, from this point, many walked with him no more. And they left. They had learned a lot. He was a good rabbi. He was giving them a new understanding of the spiritual path. He was extraordinarily charismatic. He could work miracles. There was a tremendous amount of controversy as to who Jesus was. But nonetheless, they'd had experiences. But all of a sudden, he was offering something they didn't understand. And from this point, many walked with him no more. Now what Master says about that, and you've heard me repeat this many times, but it's so important. It wasn't a test of who Jesus was. Jesus didn't need to prove anything. Jesus just shone his light, and if you wanted to stand in it, you could. He wasn't forcing anybody to do anything, and his realization was assured. It was a test of the disciples' capacity to trust their own intuitive experience, because Jesus knew that the storm that was coming, if they weren't rock firm in their own experience, the storm would just blow them off the path anyway. So they might as well, you know, they didn't need to go through that karma. So then there's an exchange in the Bible between Peter and Jesus, because many walked with him no more. And the Bible being so terse, but I think of that as many of the experiences that I've been through with Ananda over the years. In the course, it's changed slightly recently since Swami's passing, but every 5 years, pretty much like clockwork from the early 70s, something would happen that would just be a huge challenge to people's commitment to Ananda. The fire came and burned us down. Swami stopped being a monastic and he got married. SRF sued us, and then Bertolucci sued us. I put in there, Swami wrote the Festival of Light, which might not sound like much to most people, but it was like suddenly, quote, making Ananda into an institution, and that totally freaked a lot of people out. And every 5 years, the vibration would intensify in some way that some people couldn't understand, and they would leave. And sometimes people that you really loved left. When these changes would happen, you know, my best friends have just left. People that I've looked to as my companions are no longer committed. What does that mean about me? So when I think about that, I think about the context. Many walked with him no more. There's no list in the Bible of which of Peter's best friends now no longer trusted Christ or wanted to follow him. But it must have been a huge upheaval. So Jesus says to Peter, and again, there's no tone in the Bible, but I imagine a tone. So, Peter, what are you going to do? And knowing Swamiji, having been all of those things, it wouldn't be an accusatory. It wouldn't be an accusatory tone. It wouldn't be a tone that had any emotional overtone to it, because Jesus would have known that if the disciple does not fully trust his own experience, the guru can't interfere. The guru can respond, but he can't create that commitment. So he would have to say it to Peter. What are you going to do? You know, your brother, your cousin, your best friend, your childhood sweetheart, you know, your wife, who knows? Everybody is left. What are you going to do? And then Peter says, where could I go, Lord? Which is exactly the right answer, which is, I may not know either what's going on, but I know who you are. I know who you are to me. And there's no part of my consciousness that can imagine life except life with you. And that's where Swami says, follow your inspiration. And if your inspiration changes, then have the courage to follow your inspiration as it goes. Now, did every disciple who left Master make a good decision? Who left Christ, did they make a good decision? I don't know. But they were all exercising the right muscle, which is they were acting according to what they thought was true, not what the threat of hellfire or eternal damnation or no external form. It was right from the heart. So that's what Swami says, right from the heart. Follow your own experience. Which line should you personally follow? I would say again, go where you feel inspired. And then what Swami gives us, which is a very short and simple ceremony for confirming that relationship. And that's where we'll begin tomorrow. God bless you, my friends.